Hello and welcome to show 39 of the RCR, the Retro Computing Roundtable, the show of retro love, recorded Sunday, November... What's the day today?
25th?
25th. Sunday, November 25th, 2012. Will I ever find my way back to us? Our audiophiles are hosted by CyberEars, and they can host your podcast or audiophiles too. So go to cyberears.com to check them out, and we thank them for their sponsorship. My name is Carrington Vanston, and once again, I am using the very large compensation size microphone. And joining me today is a man comfortable enough with his masculinity to use a teeny tiny little mic, Earl Evans. Welcome, Earl.
Hey, Carrington. How are you today, my friend?
I'm awesome.
Well, good.
That's the short answer.
So it's an audio podcast, but I have a video question. I have turned down the intensity of my laptop screen so as to reduce the glare off of my glasses. Is it working?
Yes.
Excellent. So now people can see my baby blues.
Are your eyes blue? They look black.
No, actually, they're brown. They're brown.
Oh.
But
they look black like your soul.
Sounded good. Yes. The eyes are the window to your soul, aren't they? All right, I'm going to do the rest of the show with my eyes closed because it
Better.
Is an audio podcast.
In fact, if you could just turn around, that would work.
I'm not going to show my bald spot.
Oh, I'm going to show only bald spot. The Magic 8-Bald. Look in and answer your question. Ask your questions. Okay, Earl, let's get to the news. Items of interest.
Right.
I am interested in items, and I want to talk about the most interesting ones. And you have queued up for the first, introducing the low-tech XTCF-V2. That's a lot of letters and numbers, Earl. What the heck does it mean?
But we retro people love letters and numbers. And in particular, we love these letters and numbers because what it means is you can use a compact flash card in your old IBM, as old as the 5150.
Wow, that's old school.
It is. It's beautiful. And, of course, we've talked many times on the podcast about the failure of retro computing devices, particularly mechanical devices, things that have an analog component, like hard drives or monitors. This takes care of one of those problems.
So this works sort of like a CFFA card does for the Apple II?
Exactly. It doesn't, from what I read, I don't think that it has all of the whiz-bang super cool features of a CFFA card, but and that's what they mean by the low-tech, but it is a very high-speed device from what I read here. Apparently, the design that has been used to create this card can enable up to 530 kilobytes per second.
Can the computer, 5150 is not going to be able to keep up with that.
No, well, I mean, you know, a 5150 is going to have max, right, 640K, unless you've got some sort of extended memory card. And so you could fill up your RAM in just over a second.
If you can bring it in. So for those playing along at home, you can check it out over at lowtech.co.uk, and that's spelled lowtech.co.uk. So those in the chat room if you want to go check it out. So it looks really cool. It's a neat-looking little card. So you got your
– it is.
Just like your basic I like the way that this is designed, that the CF card will stick out the back of the unit. So clearly you can get access from without having to open up the computer. So that's a good design.
That's important. Mm-hmm. And also, it looks like a small enough card that if you had an IBM 5155, that portable, you might be able to fit this in there. One of the problems with the 5155 is that it really lacked expansion ports. Your three main full length expansion ports were taken up with other stuff. And so what you were left with was a bunch of half-length ports that really you couldn't use for a whole lot. But if you had this card, you could pop it in there. This could be your hard drive, and it would turn a 5155 into a nice little device.
Sure, I can tell from the shape of the card here that it doesn't extend any farther into the machine than just right at the edge of the slot itself.
Like, exactly.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so that's nice.
And so is it something for sale now?
No, not quite yet. Apparently, if you want to register your interest, you can. Here's what is stated at the end of this blog entry. Many would-be home assemblers are unfortunately put off by the surface mount components, but it's perfectly possible to assemble one at home with some basic tools. I don't know. Surface mount scares me. I've never done any of that myself. But PCBs are available for anyone wanting the satisfaction of building their own. The cost of components is minimal, and there's a wiki where they have assembly notes and a programming guide for the main brain of this thing, which is a CPLD chip. It says, separately, I'm organizing a batch of about 20 assembled boards as a kind of public beta over the next few weeks. Watch this space.
Nice.
So cool. A couple of people in the comments have already posted their interest, and if you're interested in it, you should go on over there and do the same.
Yeah, so lo-tech.co.uk. Very cool. So for the low-tech XTCF V2, so many letters.
Indeed.
So speaking of old stuff, old tech, what a surprise. Our next item of interest is also retro. It's
what
almost like that's what this show is about. This is something that I think you were talking to somebody else, had mentioned it on Twitter. And then you said, hey, that's neat. How did that miss us? And I think you threw it into the show notes. I've been aware of this for a while. So this is Cathode, which you can find over at secretgeometry.com. It's a vintage terminal emulator for Mac OS X. And by what I mean is it's a replacement for your terminal program on Mac OS X. So you just open it up and it's a terminal. But the vintage bit is the look. So what's really neat about it is it has all these effects. So you can pick your fonts, all of which are retro-looking fonts. By default, it comes with a green font with the scan lines. And it even does this neat effect where it bulges out the screen so it looks like you're viewing it on an old CRT. It has a couple of details that really make, like, the... It's not just that it bulges. The details really make it, incredibly finely done. Because
it makes it look like an old-school CRT.
Well, right? But you pick it. I don't know if you've actually used this. Because I have... there's another app by the same company called Blinky, which is basically this just as a text editor. And Cathode is the text editor part plus a full terminal. And so how it works is you can pick your type of terminal, and you can pick... So you're emulating a specific sort of CRT, and you want an orange one, you want a green one, what have you. But you can also pick an image, and it places that image as a reflection on the CRT. So when you're looking at it, you'll see as if behind you is the window or whatever you selected as reflecting off the CRT. It's incredibly realistic. It can also do a couple of really neat features. If you open it in the image, like you go grab a JPEG and you open it with this or with Blinky, it immediately converts it into ASCII art. And as you scale, you just grab the window and make it larger or smaller, it just scales up the number of characters until you get the ASCII art. So it's a great ASCII art.
Nice.
Turn green or whatever you're looking for. So that's really nice. It will also take your webcam feed and put that into ASCII art live. So I wish I could do it right now, but unfortunately I can't to show you, but it's a really cool effect. So you can just get live ASCII art webcam. So really neat things. Like it's your standard terminal, but it's these little aesthetic details that really separate it. So it's $10, that's it, from secretgeometry.com. And if you don't want the terminal part, all you're looking for is a text editor that does all of this, including the webcam stuff, including the ASCII art pictures, all of that. That's only $5. You can get that called Blinky from the same company in the Mac App Store. And I've had Blinky for a while, and I really like it. One of the downsides to Blinky and Cathode as a text editor is it is very retro. It's very bare bones, so which is okay if you're looking for like a full screen plain text editor. Like say you're one of these people, you know, there's a lot of word processors out there, and the idea is they get rid of all the clutter and all the screen GUI stuff so that you're just doing text editing, you're just writing, like doing the single task things. This is a really nice version of those because it will do the full screen, take over your whole screen with the Cathode stuff or not. You can pick how much of that you want. You can minimize it. You can make it rounded like it's on a CRT or not. I like to use it just as a full screen text editor with nice green text. One of the downsides is, though, it's one of the few plain text editors that doesn't do auto spell check, like no underlines, no anything. So it's just you and a keyboard. Welcome to the 80s.
But just like the good old days.
Yeah, for $5, it's totally worth it, though. I've been very happy with Blinky for ages now. So, secretgeometry.com, really, really nice terminal emulator with cool effects.
Very cool. Yep. Very cool. And thanks to Andy for shooting us an email and letting me know about that. It makes
Andy,
me use...
Andy Malloy?
Yeah.
Oh, Andy's awesome. Way to go.
He
Hello,
is
Andy.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And it makes me wish that I was using a Mac as my primary machine. In fact, that's one of the things that Andy was saying. Too bad that it's not also available for Windows, because this is
Well, I think it's using a lot of the built-in Mac stuff to sort of drive these fancy graphics. There's a lot of graphics horsepower, I think, going in to make this very simple terminal emulator.
I see.
It's nice, though. It's really, really like it.
And a couple of the comments that we got on the last topic in the YouTube channel, one is, it's a pain to do surface mount soldering, but with practice, it's possible to do it with just tweezers and a quality soldering iron. And probably for me, also some way to amplify my poor eyeballs, because my eyesight's not what it used to be. And another posting, hot air tools make it that much easier. So, and I've heard from a number of hobbyists that surface mount is possible in the hobby environment. It's just not quite as easy as through-hole stuff.
A couple of times, especially back in high school, I've been called a hot air tool, so maybe I could come over and help.
Yes, you could. You could probably do surface mount without tools. It would be awesome.
It would just be me and the force of will. speaking of coming over... By which I mean going out, by which I mean going to places. Tell
yes.
me about this SX64 party business happening in January, I think it is. Is SX64 as in the 64?
As in the portable version
right.
of the Commodore
64. Right.
Yes.
So why is there a party for those in January?
Well, because it's coming up on an anniversary of its actual release, and so we're going to party. And
party of, like it's 1979?
Yeah, and part of the party is taking your SS64, SX64, first day with my new mouth, sorry, and a group of your friends and headed for your local cafe and plug in and compute. Or
that
as we
awesome.
Would say on this show, retro compute.
Retro compute. So people will come into a Starbucks and they'll look around and they'll see a bunch of people with their laptops, a couple of hipsters with their pen and paper, and then some dude sitting there with an SX64.
Hopefully many people sitting there with an SX64. There's already three of these, it sounds like, if you go to the website, that have been arranged for, I think, the 20th of January. Is when they're going to do this. And so if you were to go to one of those coffee shops, you would see one of two things. Either you'd see a bunch of people sitting there enjoying the retro computers, or you'd see the police escorting a bunch of people out of the cafe with their retro computers in tow. Because
they burned it down?
Yes, exactly. One of the things that I'm wondering is Starbucks or wherever they're going to meet going to have enough wattage to handle this?
You know, well, how much power do those draw?
You know, it's not terribly bad, but it's just going to be the idea of it. You know, I mean, people are going to show up with their plug bar, and you're going to have five wires going off to your various SX64s. I think it's actually going to be humorous. Somebody should capture this on video.
Absolutely. Did the SX64 have any truly portable options? Like, is there a battery pack or anything
nope.
like that for it?
Nope.
So it's strictly a luggable.
You got to plug in, yes.
Okay.
Strictly runs off AC.
So what if people just bring extension cords running from their houses?
I think that would work. It I mean, depending on how close they are to the coffee shop.
The further, the better. I like it. It's a good plan. So this is happening in January. And where can people find out about where...
Well, so it's happening in January, but you can go... they're saying, you know, let's go all the way through the year. If you can't do one of these parties on that particular January, they're saying, you know, that's all right. Just do it when you can do it.
Cool.
And
so we'll have a link in the show notes, but where is the actual... like, what's the URL
for? I'm going to that page right now. I thought I had it up in a tab, but I don't. If you go to c64.berrydejager, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It's BerryDejager, berrydejager.com.
Okay.
/SX64Party. And it's the 8-bit living blog, and you'll find this blog posting about Commodore SX64 party at Starbucks. They're saying at Starbucks or just whatever is the local coffee brewer of your choice.
Nice. And at that site, can people sign up to pick a new place? Like if they want to say, like say we want to have one here in Toronto, can you?
Yes, indeed they can.
Nice. Excellent.
And the three that are already set up are in Amsterdam, Fresno, California, and Seattle, Washington.
Nice. Okay, one outside of the U.S. Go international.
Yes, indeed.
That's what I say. Very, very cool. So let's, if you think that computer's big, if you think lugging an SX64 is big, that's nothing compared to our next topic, which is a witch. The witch computer has been reactivated, according to the BBC News report. So over at bbc.co.uk, we'll just have a link in the show notes, you'll never find it. So the witch computer, that stands for, what does that stand for? The Wolverhampton Instrument for Teaching Computation from Harwell. Clearly a made-up sort of acronym. It's a backronym, yeah. So originally, this is one of those, it's big metal. Like it's from, it looks like it first got switched on in 1951 is when it went into operation. So built in the late 40s. It's now at the National Museum of Computing, the TNMOC in Bletchley Park. And it's one of those, you know, couple of tons of computing, big iron. I just love these old things with the big glowing diodes and the racket of switches and clicks and clacks when it's operating. There's a great video on the BBC site that we'll link to that shows it in operation. And what I found exciting about this is a couple of things. The witch, this computer, as it got named, being in operation since 1951 is now, it's fully operational again, it's complete, working perfectly, they're running programs to it very slowly, which makes it the oldest still working fully digital computer, so that's really exciting. And it was sort of taken apart, and for a number of years it was just dismantled, lying all over the place, and so it's, for a whole bunch of years now, there's been a project on to try to get it back together, to find all those original parts that had been left around, and they have rebuilt it from almost all complete original parts. They would go through the boxes and bins and use photographs of the early computer and find the actual parts. They've reassembled it, got it all up working again. What's neat about this computer is it's based on decimal numbers instead of binary. And so each bit, as it were, like each of the little cylinders in there actually holds a number from 0 through 9, or a number from 1 to 10, it looked like, weirdly. And
is that why they call it the Decatron?
Exactly. So it was a Harwell Decatron to start with, and the Deca, because it's, even though they spelled it D-E-K, Decatron, it's based on decimal with a C. And if you watch the video, what's really cool is on the front, there's all these little tubes that glow. And I love computers with glowing tubes. That's totally awesome. But on them, they're actually little glowing dials. And you can look at the dial and see what number is being stored at that tube. So you look at it and say, oh, that's got a 2, that's got a 4, that's got a 9. It only holds 90 numbers, like this total memory space of 90. But those numbers are each from 1 to 10. So it's more than equivalent of 90 binary units. So it was used originally through 1951 through late 1950s as an actual computer for atomic scientists to do calculating. And it really wasn't much faster than just a guy with a calculator of some sort.
But probably it reduced human error.
Well, it is. And that the two big things we're saying is it didn't make mistakes, provided the program was correct, you know, garbage in, garbage out. But also, it would run solid. It was really reliable. You could run it 80 hours a week, and it would just go. So they would feed in things, and it would just do the hours that you couldn't get a human to do and not make mistakes after 79 hours straight.
Right,
that
doesn't get tired. Good
yeah,
point.
So it's funny how that was one of the big advantages of early computing. I never really thought about that. It wasn't necessarily speed. It was just long, long calculations with no errors at the end of them after, you know, 50-hour runs, that kind of stuff. So that was interesting. And then after late 50s, 57 or so, is when it moved over and became a teaching computer. So people would learn on it, and one of the big advantages was, since it was so visual, just, you know, coincidentally, the way it was built, all these little tubes would show you this number's here, that number's here, and it works for a punch, so it gets these long punch tapes that have to be punched by hand, but as you feed it in, you can actually watch, like, it's a living computer, so I hear this number came in, see, it just got transferred over, that
really
four,
see the gears and, turning.
Exactly, yep. So it's a great teaching computer, and so the nice thing is, they're now going to start to do that again. So at the National Museum of Computing, they have little classes to introduce people to computing, to show them vintage computing, like what the state of, like, 1940s computing was, but also, when you feed a program in, a simple, like, let's add a number, you can visually see the number get added, and really understand the way it works. So it's, I found that really interesting, and it's exciting that this old computer has now found a new place, and that it's, you know, looks beautiful, working perfectly, great restoration job.
Tip of the hat to the National Museum of Computing for this project. That must have taken an incredible amount of hours and an incredible amount of dedication to put that thing back together and preserve for generations to come. So I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, we'll have a link in the show notes so you can head over to the BBC site and see that there's a video that accompanies this, and you can watch them load in the paper tape and hear the machine and see it and see the little dials, and visually it's really interesting to watch it in operation. So.
Now, I wonder if you happen to be lucky enough to be a local that could make it over to Bletchley Park, I'm wondering if you could actually see this thing in action. I'm wondering if it's going to be one of their displays.
Mark, you have to be a spy.
Oh, okay.
When they bring in children, it's children spies. It's
gotcha.
Like the spy kids come in. You have to be a spy. I don't know. I would presume so. If they're having classes for kids, it must be something open to the public. So.
Beautiful.
It was just on November 20th is when it's now been sort of unveiled. So it's less than a week old. So what about you? What is this JavaScript machines thing you've got queued up for next? JavaScript, that sounds newfangled. That doesn't sound retro, Earl.
It's new and old. One is silver and the other is gold. Isn't that the way the saying goes? So,
where's my mute button? Where is it? I'm hosting. There must be a mute button somewhere.
So in this case, you've got a browser running a full emulation of an IBM 5150 computer.
Oh, cool.
I think this is awesome. So you can go over there and you can boot up the computer. Then you can choose from a couple of different programs that they've got in the pull-down menu, one of which is VisiCalc. You can load that up and see what it was like to compute with that spreadsheet. You do it all within your browser. And if you don't want the old 4.77 megahertz speed, you can hit the fast button and really turbo it up and make it go much faster. But I think it's amazing today what we're able to do just within the context of a browser.
That's so awesome.
If you click the link to the PCJS emulator, one of the things you'll find is an expanded version of that emulator that gives you a debug console showing you the contents of all of the registers in the 8088 processor. Again, kind of going back to what we were just talking about, giving you a look under the hood of what's going on when the computer is running.
And so I can say that it does work, because I have just, screw that working business. I didn't put in VisiCalc. It's got Microsoft Adventure, so I loaded that instead, and it fired right up for me. Yeah, totally awesome.
So a very fun emulation. Must be apparently pretty lightweight, but again, the power of modern computing, it's getting to where you'll be able to emulate a 5150 on your thumbnail.
But it's funny how many of these things are starting to exist, like people are emulating old computers in browsers using JavaScript and other technologies. Oh, I should point out that people playing along at home, you can find this at jsmachines.net, all one word. So we'll have a link in the show notes as well.
Yes, and if you scroll down to the bottom, you'll see not only is there an emulation of a 5150 available, but you can also emulate an Ohio Scientific Challenger, I believe it is.
Very cool.
So yeah, definitely head on over and check that out.
Nice choice. I am going to counter with something larger.
You'll see my JavaScript and raise me
a giant robot with eye lasers. Well, not eye lasers, but sensitive eyes. George the Robot. I'm going back to the BBC. Like, for me, this show is going to be all about big iron and Britishness. So God save the Queen. So George the Robot, one of the oldest humanoid robots. The first version was built by a fellow named Tony Sale back when he was 19, before World War II. So early, and around robot. The second version, he added radio control on the George Mark II, and then that one got on TV, and it was very hard for them to record on TV because the radio frequencies, it was so powerful, it would mess up all the broadcast stuff. So totally awesome. And he added a moving jaw to simulate speech. And so this one that they have dug up and has been restored and is working again is the George Mark V, Mark V. It was built right at the end of World War II, so that's how old this is. Massive, giant, metal, walking around robot. It was stored in his garage, Tony Sale, for about 45 years. And the BBC were researching Wallace and Gromit's World of Invention, and they sort of read about this thing, so they contacted this guy and said, hey, do you have any pictures? Do you have anything left over? Because we saw little bits of this TV stuff from way back in the early 40s, this robot. And he goes, oh, I've got them in the garage. So
wow.
They walk him out. It's like, oh, he goes back. He goes, oh, yeah, it's been here for like 45 years. He sort of forgot about it. And he said, what is it? What's the quote? It's a great one. I put some oil on the bearings, added a couple of new lithium batteries, switched them, and away he went. It just works. Walks around. It's totally awesome. So this is the version that added light-sensitive eyes. So this is a guy working from home with spare parts he would find lying around that were just left around after the war. He builds a giant 8-foot-tall metal robot that's remote-controlled, jaw move, big like metal jaw moves, like terrifying looking, and added light-sensitive eyes back like in 44, I guess it was built in 46, so that it could, like, you can illuminate a beer bottle and it'll find it and zoom in on it and stuff, and like, crazy. And this thing just still works perfectly. He built it in a way that still just works perfectly.
How fun. And there's a video that shows this?
On there as well, and you can see it, and you can see the size of this giant metal thing, and you watch it sort of scooch forward. It like rolls, but it's just giant. So it's one of the oldest humanoid robots, and they put some oil on it, and he's been just sitting by himself in this garage for 45 years. So really cool story about this guy who just had a robot that he built as a kid, and it has chomping metal sharp jaws and sensitive eyes. Just crazy that somebody didn't get killed by this thing. Anyway. Totally love it. Cool. The whole story just really, really, really chimed me. I just think it's just awesome. So, George the Robot.
Hey, I got some more comments here on the tube.
What are your comments?
One is, I think we're going to get a spanking here. There's comment that the website wasn't updated, and so they thought there was no show today.
Oh, maybe that's my fault.
Well, we'll make sure to fix that in the future. Also, Barry DeJager is actually in the chat and says, please join the SX64 party. This is going to be fun. Indeed it is. And Barry, am I pronouncing your last name right? Is it possible for you to, just post a comment there and give me a smack if I'm not saying that right? Also, there's some information on how much power the SX64 takes, because you were talking about that. It's only 42 watts. Running idle at 220 volts, having the drive active, the power went up another 9 watts, but still not much higher than a laptop. That's true.
Nothing.
Yeah, 50 watts, that's easy.
Well, with those tiny little screens. Even
tiny
even
little
CRT,
color screen, yeah. I mean, it's only a 4-inch CRT, so shouldn't be bad at all.
And if somebody doesn't have one of those, what they could bring is a tiny little laptop and run that terminal emulator we were talking about, and it'll be the same sort of experience.
Yes, it'll look exactly like it.
So just bring a tiny little Macintosh.
And Barry says, check out my blog on this party, which we'll definitely have a link up to that, Barry.
Yeah, we'll make sure we have a link in the show notes.
Yep. So what do we got next, Carrington?
Next, you ask me? It's on you. It's all on you, Earl. Vice.
Me?
Vice. You're going to clearly make our show dirty. You've got something called Vice you want to talk about.
We do, yes. Yes. Lots of my friends have been trying to talk me into Vices for years, but I'm going to talk about this one Vice, the Versatile Commodore Emulator. This thing is awesome. It emulates just about every Commodore known to man, the VIC-20, the Commodore 64, the Commodore 128, all of the PETs, the Plus 4. I mean, this thing's amazing. So, and this team, the Vice team, just keeps going with this emulator, adding new features. This emulator runs on just about every operating system you can think of. It runs on Unix, it runs on Windows, it runs on Mac OS X, it runs on BIOS, it runs on just a ton of stuff. But the 2.4 update adds some things that I thought were really cool. One is the Commodore 128 emulation gets a little boost here, I think in the Z80 CPM mode, if I was reading it right. Also, they've added an emulation of the sound of the 1541 drive. I've seen another emulator do this. I can't remember
which Virtual one it was. 2. Virtual 2 for the Mac is an Apple II emulator. My favorite 8-bit Apple II emulator, I'll put it that way. I like Sheppy's Sweet 16 better in general. But the Virtual 2 emulates the drives as well. So when you put a disk image in, you hear the sound of the disk sliding into the drive and you hear the grinding of it. It's really awesome.
And what was the other Vice change that they... Oh, yes. There is a PET that was kind of like the... Well, they called it the Super Pet because it really was pretty super. It had two CPUs in it, and it had a number of languages in it designed for computer science education.
Did it have a cape?
It did, yes. It
then
came
it
with a
super.
Cape. Yes, it was very super. No capes. So
good movie.
So the emulation of that machine has also gotten better in this new version of Vice. So if you like any of the Commodores, you got to go check this out.
So it's a Vice version?
It is.
I love
you. Oh, you're such a card, Carrington.
I'm an incorrigible punster, so do not encourage me.
And you can find this at vice-emu.sourceforge.net.
Oh, for emulator.
Emulator, yes.
What's it, an emu?
Emus. Emus nice. And their vices.
Are you keeping up with the Commodore? Because the Commodore is keeping up with you.
The Commodore 64, now in a home family pack. A family pack containing the world's number one selling home computer. A data cassette and joystick. A comprehensive teach-yourself program plus three additional software packages. The Commodore Family Pack now available from your Commodore dealers and major retail stores. Now that's value for money.
Are you keeping up with the Commodore? Because the Commodore is keeping up with you.
But you know what? It's time for now, Earl. It's time for me to give you a gift.
I love this part.
I'm going to give you the gift of a gift idea. That's all I got for you.
What? God, that's it. I'm out of here.
It is time to add a gift to our retro computing gift guide. That's over at rcrpodcast.com.
Which, by the way, is an extremely useful gift guide.
Or will be useful later, definitely, when I'm looking for stuff. Or to remind me of things that I'm interested
in. I'm just saying I took an item from that gift guide and actually put it on my Christmas list.
See? There you go. Yes. Yes,
so
it's basically a whole guide of stuff.
I'm not just an RCR host, I'm also a client.
Nice. So, adding to our retro computing gift guide this month, I have selected teeny tiny little model arcade game cabinets. As you know, I've been doing another podcast called No Quarter, so I'm all into
arcade. I love that podcast.
Yeah, totally fun. So, but I'm all into arcade games at the moment, and that is through that that I stumbled on this. You can find it over at mk.net, and that's spelled E-M, like Mary, K-A-Y.net. M-K. Hmm. Oh, sorry. E-M-D-K-A-Y. It's really, I don't know why it's, but E-M-D-K-A-Y.net. We'll have a link in the show notes. And so this fellow makes these tiny little cabinets you can get. It would be the size, if you have an original Star Wars action figure and you wanted that Star Wars action figure to have a Sinistar cabinet or an Asteroids cabinet, this is the right size. Little tiny things. They sell for like $20, $25. Amazing little collectibles. I just love that. He makes pinball machines as well. And they're really detailed. Like
they've got
the little art, they've got the side art, the cabinet art. I just love them. So just a fantastic little thing, like $25. So if you know somebody who's really into coin-op machines or that kind of stuff, vintage gaming, I think this would make a great little stocking stuffer. Or somebody's got like a shelf of collectibles. I don't think they work.
I thought I was looking at one that worked here. Maybe I'm looking at something different than what.
Well, it's got art put on it. So if you get like the Tempest machine, it'll have like the art going, but it's not really functional. I think it's just a little collectible toy. But there's Pac-Man and there's like Ms. Pac-Man and just tons and tons of different ones. I think it also does commissions. So there's a huge, huge range of them, and I just think they're adorable and neat.
Beautiful.
And I can just see them looking great on a shelf with retro collectibles and retro toys. And so if you got somebody and you know what their favorite game was from high school or something like that, this is a great little commemorative gift for $25.
So how big are these?
That big.
I wasn't looking at you. Do it again.
They're smaller than a head.
Head or the average head?
I think they look like about 6 to 8 inches. It looks smaller than an old school G.I. Joe and bigger than an old school Star Wars character is what it looks like.
Very fun.
So there's a few images where you can see them with little Star Wars guys at them, and they seem sized correct for that. So anyway, it just really caught my eye. So emdkay.net, totally dig them. So those are going into the gift guide. And speaking of things to purchase, we've also got auction choices. And Earl the Pearl. What have you got for us this week? What should people run out and buy and compete and bid on?
Recently, for my own collection, I was trying to build up a machine that would have a 5 1/4 drive, a 3 1/2 drive, and a BIOS that would support both of those things, and also would let me kind of live the old DOS years. So I did wind up cobbling together a Frankenstein. It had a bit newer chip than I was hoping to go with. It has a Pentium 3 450. And while that works just great, and it's a nice tweener machine, it's running Windows 98, and it lets me get back and forth between my old machines and my new machines. Basically, one of the reasons I wanted to do this was so that I could stamp out 5 1/4 floppy software for my K-Pro.
Why don't you get so stamp out the 5 1/4 floppy.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to stamp that sucker out right now. Now, you know, I wanted to have a machine that would give me a bridge between the old and the new, but it'd be fun if it was a little older, a little more retro. And so I was poking around on eBay, and I found this 38640 machine in an old AT-styled mini tower case. And it looks like it's in really good shape. Not just that, but I think the price is reasonable. The starting bid is $50. You can do a buy it now at $75, and this thing's pretty loaded. If you look at what it's got in it, it's got the AT form factor mini case, 386 motherboard with AMI BIOS. It's got both the 5 1/4 and 3 1/2, a 170 meg hard drive, a Trident Super VGA card. Those were very popular back in the day. We used to load them up in all of our 286, 386,
sure,
486 machines.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. AT style keyboard port and all of the other ports you'd expect. Two parallel ports, two serial ports, and not just that, but a 3COM 3C5X9 Ethernet adapter. And the 3COMs were the best cards that you could get back then, too. And a serial mouse. So, I mean, this thing really came loaded up. I just thought it was a good price and very complete.
Yeah, so what is the price again?
$50 if you bid on it. Or a buy it now for $75.
Nice. You know, for $50 especially, yeah, to get a good 386, what is this, a 38640DX. Mm-hmm. So, like, that's a good 386. And with a Trident, so you've got a very compatible VGA card. So it's going to work with any of the old games and stuff like that. Like, this is a good
It's a
DOS
good
boxing
DOS gaming box,
yeah, totally.
Don't you think?
Yeah, this is going to totally rock old DOS games. Nice.
Yep.
And what was the size it had a hard drive in it? What was the size of the hard drive?
170 meg.
Oh, yeah, then that's going to – you'll be able to stuff that full of DOS games. So then that's a lot of space. So nice. Yeah, you know what? For $50, that's a great price. Nice. Good choice.
So what do you have for us?
Oh, I'm going – because I've picked all these giant BBC, British, God Save the Queen things, I had to go Apple. I had to have at least something Apple in the show.
That's
so
cool.
I have selected HyperCard 2GS. For for the 2GS, obviously.
Oh,
so
nice.
The reason I'm selecting this is something that is readily available on the net. You could download it. If you just want the discs, easy to get. And even if you want the discs plus instructions, that kind of stuff, this, I think, is still for sale. I think through Syndicom or something like that has this. So you can actually buy it. You can get this as discs and a binder in your
book.
But what's nice about this is it's $40. There is only like a day and a half left, so I'm going to get the show posted today, so people have a chance. It's still sealed, so it's got the collectible.
I was going to say, it looked like it's still shrink-wrapped.
And it's still in the vintage, because you can tell from the stripe that Apple put on their stuff back then. So it's the original shrink, which is cool, so it's collectible. But the reason I'm picking this is for $50, you have not just a nice collectible brand new in the box with all the discs and all the instructions. You've got a great rapid development environment for the 2GS. So if you're thinking of joining Earl and I next year at Kansas Fest, pick this up. You have now months to learn HyperCard, which is a great development language. In fact, the advantage of the 2GS HyperCard over the old Mac HyperCard was it came natively with color. So right away it's supporting it in a way that they had to kludge on to the HyperCard for the Mac. But HyperCard is it's got a great scripting language called HyperScript. Really easy to develop. Really easy to literally slap together. Well, maybe not literally. So a database, a point-and-click game, like a whole bunch of stuff like that. So if you're looking to come to Kansas Fest and you want to enter HackFest, but you go, I don't have time to learn how to program a Mac or program an Apple, and you want to enter an Apple II thing, bingo. Here is a full-color, rapid application development environment for the 2GS. $40, and you're good to go, and you can enter yourself into HackFest next year. So I really like HyperCard, and so I thought I like this as a price. So I think it'll appeal to people looking for rapid stuff and also people who just want to get a vintage 2GS collectible piece of software. You'll see a lot of these still in shrink. So that's my choice.
And HyperCard really is, I mean, I'll echo your sentiment that it is an excellent development environment. I missed HyperCard.
Yeah, I loved HyperCard. I was one of the people who did, I did a lot of stuff in HyperCard and SuperCard, one of the competitors. My family owned a very large, in fact, at the time, the world's largest cyber cafe called the Electric Beam here in Toronto. And the entire back end of that, the front end of that was all in HyperCard. Because of a development thing that fell through, I had like 5 days before that thing launched to launch the front end to control all the systems. And I was like, oh my God, I need a GUI front end. I need that quick. And so I slapped it together in, I think it was either HyperCard or SuperCard, one of those, and then replaced it with full apps shortly afterwards. But to make it in time for launch, and I fell in love with it by using it that way and loved it ever since, right? I still miss it. Loved HyperCard.
By the way, one of these times, either on the RCR or maybe when you and I chat on Retrobits, we ought to do a little featurette on that time that you did with the Internet Cafe.
Because we've talked
about that off camera, and that just sounds like an awesome story.
Yeah, it was an exciting time. Yeah, I loved running that thing. I'm happy to, but Retrobits.
Yeah, what is that? Hey, your audio is cutting out, which is kind of fortunate because you're dissing my podcast.
Your audio is cutting out, mister.
Also on the comments, Barry says that I pronounced his name perfectly so he doesn't have to slap me with a trout, because although Carrington always wants to slap me with a trout.
That's not a trout.
By the way, using Vice is the best while doing cross-assembly demo coding. Yes, indeed. And no, there's not an IRC chat channel for RCR podcast listeners, but that's something that I've been thinking about.
Yeah, I keep thinking that maybe some combination of streaming audio and IRC would be appropriate, but more stable than this Google Hangout stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the other thing is that there is a IRC chat program for a lot of the old retro computers, including the Commodore 64, Commodore 128, depending on which Ethernet card you've got for your Commodore and for your Apple and that kind of thing. You can get on IRC. If you wanted to go the full tilt retro, you could get on there with your retro machine and actually chat. So that's...
But how would they hear the audio?
No, I'm saying we'd have to do a combination of this and that.
We should send out... a live transcription that would come over teletype.
Yes. And you have to have it. It only works if you've got an ASR33 teletype.
Well, don't we all? You shouldn't listen to the show if you don't have one of those. You're a poser.
So
nice. Okay, so those are our auction picks. Mine is better than yours.
closing
discussions, Earl. I'm closing the door on the discussions. What is this? What else is going up in Earl land? Tell me, Earl.
So I'm reviving once more, and this time it's do or die, my effort to make a virtual disk drive for the Epson PX8 laptop, which I'll actually show in the post-game show. I've got that for a show and tell.
Very cool. So I remember you talking about this ages ago.
Yeah. I've been thinking about this for years and trying different approaches at it. And for the, the retro competition. My mind's a blank.
The retro challenge.
Retro challenge. Thank you. I tried to make a prototype for this, and I only got as far as kind of a hard-coded demo of it, but I finally beat some of the problems I was having with the serial communications. So
you beat them with the serial communication?
I did. I beat it with a hammer. So who knows? I bit-banged it, one would say. So I'm launching this effort again. If I can't make it work with a propeller microcontroller, I'm also going to try making a prototype using a Raspberry Pi. Here's the reason, and I'll talk more about this on that other podcast that I have, but the Raspberry Pi runs on Linux, and I think the best emulation software, Virtual Drive for the PX8, also runs under Linux. So if you had a Raspberry Pi for $25, $35, and that could be your virtual drive for the PX8, that would be beautiful. It'd be low cost. It runs storing the images off of an SD card. So that's something that I'm reviving is my interest in that. Because I got a new battery pack, Batteries Plus, who I really like, made me a custom battery pack for my PX8, modeled off of the old one. Works great. now that my PX8's back up and running, I'm getting back into the swing of that.
Nice. Very cool. Hey,
so another thing, we talked about me trying to build up a DOS box. And yes, one of the machines that I tried to do that with was my old HP Vectra XU. It's a dual Pentium Pro box. And I could not get the thing to network, and I tried everything. I tried PCI cards. I tried ISA cards because it's got a couple of 16-bit ISA slots. The thing just rejects the whole idea of networking. It's weird. It's just, it would lock up. I tried all the different interrupt tricks. It's like, so finally I just said, I've had it. And I built another Frankenstein machine. I thought, I'll just scrap this HP because it's not doing me any good anymore. Here's something you should think about before you go scrapping your old machine and taking it to Goodwill or whatever. Mm-hmm. Think about that a lot of these old processors had a high gold content. I was surprised to learn that the Pentium Pro actually kind of tops the list on this, that when Intel was making it, one of the ways that they squeezed as much performance as they did into this chip was giving it a high content of gold in the manufacture. And so if you were to sell your Pentium Pros just as gold scrap, you can get a pretty penny for them. They sell on eBay. I've seen them for $50, $60, $70, $80 for a pair.
That's crazy.
Pro chips. I know. And in a lot of cases, they have bent pins and different things like that, but they're not after it to make it functional. And on the vintage computer forums, there was a discussion about this, and somebody said, I've got a project that I'd actually like to buy a couple of working Pentium Pros for my project, but to do it, I have to pay more than the gold scrappers are willing to pay, and I'm not willing to pay that much. So I thought, wow, it is a good thing that I didn't cart this machine off to Goodwill for recycle before taking out the pieces that I could scrap or sell working or whatever. So
Great. If
you're going to go scrap your stuff, keep in mind that there may actually be a salvage value for some of the components in it.
Nice. There's gold in them there cases.
Pentiums.
Nice.
Very what about cool. you, Carrington? What's going on your side?
Apple stuff. Not really anything exciting, to be honest.
just kind of hanging out.
Busy, busy, crazy.
Doing
busy
your million podcasts. What's the last movie that you reviewed?
I don't even know. We did a podcast today, and that's like 2 weeks behind on posting just because I've been so busy and didn't get up. So that Double Take has sort of languished for 2 weeks. But one will go live today, but it's the one that we recorded 2 weeks ago, and I don't remember what we listened to.
So I saw a kind of mind-bending film, Inception, with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, sure. I saw that. I remember that.
Very
good
movie.
I like it very much.
So,
okay. I love doing Double Takes. Just Jerry and I got crazy, crazy busy. So we've been recording, but I'm just behind on posting it because the editing for one of them got finicky, and I just didn't have time. The shows that edit quickly, like this one and No Quarter, they just sit. Slapped out. The one episode of Double Take just needed a bunch of editing. So just kept getting pushed off. So.
And I appreciate you doing the editing work on this show.
It takes nothing. This show is nothing. But whatever. Yeah. So mostly just playing a lot of games, including I was just playing Track and Field for the Apple II. Here's the controller.
Mm, cool.
Yeah. So that's it. Just lots of gaming. Gaming for Carrington.
And thank you to the folks posting on the Vintage Computer Forum to let us know that last time I had this annoying clicking sound on the audio because I actually didn't hear it during the recording, but I have switched. Yes, there it is.
It was my flamenco dancing.
Nice maracas.
Yes.
I have eliminated the maracas. This is a no maraca show here. I'm using a different microphone.
We hope.
Not the least reason is because my headset has apparently been brokenated. So
it's a dead set.
It is. It's gone. So should be no more clicky. Except the clickety clack of keyboards.
Good to hear. So coming up after the end of the audio podcast, we will have, I believe, some show and tell. I've got some stuff to show for the people who have joined us live in the forum. But for now, I can say that our next show is going to be December 9th. You can join us live for the recording. Hopefully, I will remember to update the website accordingly. So Earl and I always tweet about it. So if you follow us on Twitter, either at rcrpodcast.com, or you can follow Earl. He's at RetroEarl, and I'm just at Carrington. So if you follow us there, we will send you reminders before the show. You can go to rcrpodcast.com for all the links that we tried to spell out and the show notes as well. And you can check out the forum. There's a link over on rcrpodcast.com. I like our forum very much, the shared forum, but fun place to hang out. Help us spread the word through the forum and through tweeting and just, you know, stopping people in elevators and chatting about the show, of course. And if you want, you can review us on iTunes. We take all comers when it comes to reviews. So feedback to the show can be sent to, surprisingly, feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And until next time, here we go, kids. Say it with me. Retro compute.